Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amber Nickel, the host of the channel, and today we are going to be talking with Maxim Goldenstein about his recent publication, So They Remember, A Jewish Family Story of Surviving the Holocaust in Soviet Ukraine, which came out this year on University of Oklahoma Press. Maxim studied journalism at the University of Washington, and in addition to penning this text, which is amazing, by the way, he has also written for several regional newspapers, including the Seattle Times. Maxim, welcome to the channel. I'm excited to discuss this text with you today.
Yeah, looking forward to speaking with you.
So let's dive right in. In your introduction, you walk readers through your motivations for writing this book and some of the obstacles that you faced along the way. Will you share this with listeners today?
You know, absolutely. And I should start by saying that I really learned about my family's history, you know, largely by accident about a decade ago when I was 23 or so. You know, and growing up as a kid living in the suburbs of Seattle, I had only kind of heard fragments here and there, mostly from my maternal grandmother, Anna. But I didn't really know to, I think, make the connections between the events and memories she shared with me and the Holocaust. She certainly didn't really describe her stories in those terms. And really, you know, broadly speaking, as an immigrant family, I remember growing up, you know, there wasn't much of a focus, I think, on looking, you know, to the past. You know, we were very focused on learning English, acculturation. You know, for my parents, you know, I'm sure it was just really, you know, about making ends meet. You know, so I don't think it was really until, again, my early 20s that I began to even wonder about my family history. And so it was in spring of 2012, basically a decade ago, that my mom, Svetlana, mentioned something to me over breakfast when I was visiting her and my dad. And she mentioned that her father, my maternal grandfather, Motel, had saved people during the Second World War. And I don't really remember the context. It was just kind of a random comment, really. And it got me thinking because it was just a startling kind of comment. And so, you know, by this point, I was visiting my grandparents, you know, pretty much every other week anyway. So I figured, you know, why not the next visit, you know, bring my notebook and pen with me. You know, I had by this point written for some regional newspapers and had journalism experience. So it was kind of second nature to want to at least record what they were saying and to preserve it, you know, just in case, you know, 5 or 10 years down the line, I would, you know, regret not having done so. And so initially I asked, you know, my grandfather, you know, about what had happened. I actually ended up speaking to him, not just on one weekend, but over, you know, a few weekends. And, you know, as he spoke, increasingly my maternal grandmother, Anna, also chimed in. And then I realized she too had an incredible story to tell. And, you know, overall, what I was hearing in the spring of 2012 was really incongruent, I think, with the popular image of the Holocaust in books and movies. Mostly, you know, in my experience, the ones I'd encountered were about the experiences of Western and Central European Jews during the war, you know, who spoke Western and Central European languages, who led very different lives before the war than my own family, as I would find out. And but more importantly, until now, I had no idea that my own family could have been, you know, subjected to the same horrors. I didn't know anything about Romania's role in the Holocaust, or even that it had actually occupied a part of Ukraine during the war. So, when I did really start to write in early 2012, I started to research, but nothing really came of it. I was quite frankly really intimidated by the sheer amount of history involved. And certainly, I basically delayed it as long as possible until finally I kind of convinced myself that the task was too large for me. But it really, as the years passed, I couldn't really stop thinking about the stories I'd heard. I was continuing to sort of read in my spare time. And as I was doing this, you know, I was struck by the fact that, you know, the story of Eastern European Jews, at least from my perspective, wasn't often represented in Holocaust literature, at least in the English language. And, you know, I was struck by the fact that, you know, for the folks who did experience it and who generally left Western Europe after surviving the Holocaust, you know, they generally described, you know, Europe and Eastern Europe as places where, you know, Jewish communities were completely erased or destroyed, or that they had vanished, you know, to use kind of some popular titles that have been written on the topic. And so I realized that over time that this actually didn't really fit the narrative of what happened to my family. You know, my family managed to survive the war and returned to the same towns where they had lived before. And in for a variety of reasons that maybe we'll get to, this was a part of Ukraine where there were parts of communities that managed to continue to exist after the war. And then even when I explored the scholarship on the Holocaust in Romania specifically, I realized that a lot of the foundational works were really focused on the experiences of Romanian Jews who were deported to this kind of territory of Ukraine called Transnistria that we'll probably talk about later. And most of the scholarship actually comes from probably people with a Romanian background or Romanian Jews who maybe moved to Israel. And so again, the story of the local Jews, the Soviet-born Jews in Ukraine, is sometimes kind of left to the margins. And so I was struck by the fact that there was a bit of a gap possibly to be filled. And the other thing I would just say lastly is that, while, you know, excavating, you know, family history over the past decade, you know, I found some interesting kind of tidbits about, you know, who my family was, you know, dating as far back as the 19th century. And I realized that, you know, the story I wanted to write wasn't just about the Holocaust. And this took me a while to truly grasp. But the story I wanted to write was also just about an ordinary Jewish family across, you know, the arc of the 20th century, a time of radical change, you know, violence, immigration, perseverance. And I think it was this understanding, this holistic picture that, you know, has helped me really understand my own Jewish identity as a Soviet-born Jew in the United States.
So before we discuss their Holocaust experiences, would you mind sharing with us a little bit more about Motol and Anna as you know them?
Yes. I was born in the city of Chernivtsi in the southwest of Ukraine in 1988. And I was basically just shy of my fourth birthday in 1992, when I remember being told that we were going to move to the U.S. And, you know, some of my earliest memories of this time, in some of those memories, my grandparents are basically ever present. And that's because, you know, they lived with my parents, my sister and I, and they continued to do so basically for the first 8 or 9 years of my life, first in Ukraine, and then during our first couple of years in the U.S. Culturally, you know, it was quite normal for 3, sometimes 4 generations even to live under one roof. And that was really to my benefit from growing up. They really in a way helped raise me when my parents were at work or when they were off at college learning English and taking the classes they would need to help us eventually get on our feet. So you know, for that to have them around, I always felt like I kind of had a protective cloak over me. You know, they were my biggest cheerleaders. I think they would probably describe themselves as providers. They would do anything necessary to help their kids, their grandkids thrive. And so, that's probably how I know them best.
You know, it's surprising that you said earlier on that you were kind of found the history aspect of this daunting, because one of the things that really stands out in your text is your ability to weave historical contexts and developments, particularly regarding the Holocaust and Romanian occupied territory and your own family story. For curious listeners, can you tell us a little bit more about how the Holocaust in Romanian occupied territory and German occupied territory differed?
Yeah, well, I should probably, you know, set the scene just a little bit as it relates to the Holocaust in Ukraine and the particular strip of land that Romania would come to control in Ukraine, in the southwest of Ukraine. This territory was called Transnistria, and importantly, it does not actually relate to the Transnistria of today, which is the breakaway region of Moldova that unfortunately has been in the news the past, you know, several weeks. The Transnistria of World War II was a territory in occupied Ukraine that the Germans essentially in August of 1941 handed over to their Romanian allies to occupy and exploit, essentially as a thank you for their enormous contributions on the Eastern Front. And as a result, interestingly, you know, Transnistria became the only sizable territory, you know, with a sizable population in the Soviet Union that was occupied by a country other than Germany. So it's pretty interesting and unique in that sense alone. And basically, by the time that the Romanians took over Transnistria from the Germans in the late summer of 41, there were about 200,000 Soviet Jews still remaining on the territory, most of them in Odessa and kind of the southern part of Transnistria. But there were, I think, about 35,000 in the smaller towns of the northern part of Transnistria, where my grandparents were born. You know, there are, I think, a variety of differences between what happened in Romanian-controlled territory and Ukraine and German-controlled territory. But I think it's worth pointing out that Ion Antonescu, the Romanian dictator, the plan initially was not to in any way keep the Jews that had been deported there for any period of time. Really, it was essentially, as the war allowed, to deport them even further east and to hand them off to the Germans to do what they will, which is probably to murder them. But what happened was that military progress didn't go according to plan, and the Germans wouldn't accept them. And so what happens is that in these territories, the Romanians were forced to essentially create a constellation of between 150 and 200 temporary ghettos and camps where the Romanian Jews and local Soviet-born Jews essentially languished for 2.5 to 3 years. And it became this prolonged humanitarian disaster that really took on apocalyptic proportions. This lasted again between the summer of 1941 and 1944. And I think it's also worth mentioning at this point that by the end of the war, as a result of what happened in Transnistria and what the Romanians did in Bessarabia and northern Bukovina, these two territories that it had reconquered from the Soviets, they were responsible for the deaths of between 280,000 and 400,000 Jewish victims, on top of maybe 12 or 13,000 Roma people. And so that gives them the distinction of being the only country other than Germany to really initiate its own program of mass killing on such a large scale. What's striking about the Holocaust in Romania, which also includes, this chunk of territory in occupied Soviet Ukraine, is that the Romanian army and military police, during their military campaign beginning in June and July of 41, start to kill entire families right away, whereas the German policy in Ukraine and throughout the Soviet Union, it doesn't really emerge until late July and August of 1941, which until then they had only been killing select men. This is particularly barbaric in Bessarabia, for example, which was immediately east of Romania. The violence is carried out against Jewish civilians there was particularly horrific. Bodies were often left on the street. There was widespread sexual violence and looting. And the behavior actually drew the ire of the German army and security forces, who repeatedly complained about this conduct in letters, not necessarily because they objected, but it, basically in the manner in which this was done. But to speak more broadly about Transnistria and the specific camps and ghettos that were set up there, the camps in particular were largely improvised, which probably differs from the popular image of the German camps. In other words, even the concentration sites were not meant to sustain life for any real duration. There were no barracks or latrines. Prisoners received no clothing. The camps often consisted of stables, pigsties, collective farms, abandoned or destroyed houses, former Red Army facilities. And again, in contrast to the Nazi camp network that maybe we like to think of, there was no cohesive system that linked maybe even one camp to the other. There was a lack of uniformity in how they worked. Things could completely differ between two neighboring camps. For example, the one that my grandfather was sent to, called Pichera, completely differed from a neighboring camp called Vapniarka. In Pichera, there was no food provided, and people were essentially left to starve or succumb to disease, to the bitter cold. And for whatever reason, in Vapniarka, which had been a former Red Army cavalry base, the prisoners were fed this kind of poisonous grass pea fodder, which was known to cause paralysis. And so, again, very, very, very different approaches. And often they were conducted in a very improvised manner. And speaking to the ghettos that dotted Transnistria, these were often very porous. Sometimes they had barbed wire, in other places, there was no barbed wire at all, because these ghettos were established in existing Jewish residential areas. And so it would have been obvious to everyone where the boundaries should exist. Some were quite large, with as many as thousands of people, while others held maybe a few dozen people. And in general, in speaking to, the Holocaust in the Soviet Union and certainly the Holocaust in Romanian occupied Ukraine, this was a very public series of events. Most of the ghettos and camps, they operated in plain sight within towns and villages. So everything that went on was certainly visible to the non-Jewish neighbors that lived nearby, certainly within earshot. One other thing that was quite different in the Romanian occupied territory of Ukraine was the attitude of the locals. I think some of the best known works about the Holocaust in Ukraine take place in the western part of the country as we know it today. And this was a territory that had been under Soviet rule only for a couple of years, since 1939. And the attitudes in general looked quite different from what happened to the east, in the south of Ukraine and the southwest of Ukraine. And as a result, there are many theories about why things look the way they did, but essentially many locals in this part of Ukraine actually came to the aid of Jewish prisoners in the camps and ghettos and actually helped them survive. And there's a variety of, again, theories as to why this was, but many people believe it has a lot to do with the fact that anti-Semitism was basically outlawed as soon as the Soviet Union was formed, that there were a variety of programs to integrate Soviet Jews in society, to help counter some of the stereotypes that went on, and to help promote positive images of Jews. So there's a lot still to be learned there. And I think another interesting thing is that despite the really horrific nature at the start of the war, and the horrific conditions in the camps and ghettos at the beginning of the Romanian campaign, this was actually a place where, again, there was a slight chance of survival, because the course of the war took a drastic turn in the fall of 1942, and the Romanians moderated their policy, whereas in German-controlled Ukraine, they continued until much of the population that remained was wiped out. And then lastly, I think when we think about the Holocaust in Ukraine, I think the term Holocaust by bullets inevitably comes to mind for certain people. And that's certainly true in Transnistria, because there were quite notable instances in which people were killed in mass shootings. And this happened primarily in Odessa and in southern Transnistria. But in the towns to the north, where there was this enormous constellation of ghettos and some camps, this was actually exceedingly rare. And most people didn't experience this. People were instead really left to, again, languish in these improvised camps and ghettos. And they suffered disease, starvation, extreme cold. This was one of the coldest winters of the 20th century, et cetera. So it was very difficult to survive, but certainly more possible. And there were fewer active measures. So there are quite a few differences, I would say.
So kind of moving away from this crucial historic context into your own family story, can you briefly sketch the outlines of Molton Anna's experiences in Romanian-occupied Ukraine?
Yeah. Well, both of my maternal grandparents, Molton and Anna, were born in small towns in what was then known and what is still known now as Vinnytsia province, which is in the southwest of Ukraine. My grandfather was born in the town of Tulchin in 1929, which was in many ways kind of a typical market town. And just before the war, there were something like 5,600 Jews living there, although many would be drafted into the Red Army or try to escape the German occupation. And so there were about 3,000 left at the time of the German occupation in July of 1942. My grandfather was 12 when this happened. His older sister, Manya, was 14, and they had a 5-year-old sister and a 2-year-old brother, and their parents lived with them. And it took about, again, kind of a month or so for the Germans first to arrive. And they encountered a town of mostly children, women, and the elderly, again, for some of the reasons that I mentioned. And most people could not escape because there was no train station and there was no effort on the part of local authorities to in any way create any kind of organized evacuation. And within a couple of months, Tulchin is essentially incorporated into Transnistria and becomes occupied by Romanians. And then there's a decree in the fall which forces everyone to relocate to within the confines of a few streets in what had been the former Jewish quarter. And this becomes the Tulchin ghetto. And not surprisingly, typhus epidemics became widespread in places like Tulchin, which it often does, in places where people live in cramped quarters, where it's difficult to find changes of clothes, where hygiene practices aren't really possible. So an epidemic of typhus began in the Tulchin ghetto too. And, you know, this really panicked the Romanian gendarmes, the military police that were left in the rear, because they were worried that it would spread to their own men. They were worried that it would affect the supply lines. And so beginning that fall and winter, there was a massive relocation of the Jews of Tulchin, around 3,000, to a newly created death camp about 35 kilometers away. And this was, you know, for lack of a better word, to essentially quarantine them. And so in December of 1941 begins the process of the deportation. They are first forced onto the streets and then forced into a nearby school without food and water, where they stay for a couple of days. And then 3 days after that, they're forced on a long, quite horrific march to the village of Pichera, which became the setting for the death camp that my grandfather was sent to. You know, before the war, the village had been the site of a sprawling estate owned by before the Russian Revolution, the village had been the setting for a sprawling estate owned by a prominent Polish noble family. And then after the revolution, in some years past, it became actually repurposed for a Soviet tuberculosis sanitarium. And so these are the grounds where the hospital was established. And again, this was a place where Jews were essentially left without food, water, without sanitation, without medicine, eventually the Romanians aimed to deport them further east into German hands, but That, of course, did not happen because the war took a decisive turn. And for my grandmother, Anna, the story was similar, except that she was born in a town called Krasne, not far from Tulchi, and also kind of in the northern reaches of what would be called Transnistria. And she was just about four when the German occupation and subsequently Romanian occupation began. And she lived with her older sister and mother and some relatives in a ghetto that was established in the town. Eventually, they were relocated into another ghetto. And for her, one of the, I think, defining the tragedies of the war, in addition to what happened to her family that was in the ghetto, was the fact that her father was killed while in the Red Army. And this was quite a common experience for a lot of people in the Soviet Union.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think another thing that really this narrative that you expertly weave highlights is the ways in which developments on the Eastern Front affected day-to-day life and instances of survival in the camps and ghettos of Transnistria. Can you share with us a little bit about how these developments affected outcomes?
Absolutely. Well, the first winter in 1941 and 1942 was especially brutal. Many tens of thousands of people died due to some of the factors I mentioned earlier. And there again is, particularly in the southern territories, a variety of mass shootings that decimated the population, the Jewish populations interned in some of these areas. But what happens is that even before the Romanians and Germans suffer setbacks at Stalingrad, the Romanians, led by wartime dictator Antonescu, they sense that the tides of war are changing, and that there's a good chance that they may not win. So their policy begins to moderate. For many of the Jewish prisoners in the camps and ghettos, there is now a sense that if they can, you know, perhaps survive for another year or two, they can outlast the war. For my grandfather, he again was imprisoned in a camp called Pechera in the Pechera village, and there was a very unique situation there in that the camp was surrounded by stone walls, but it was quite possible for children his age to scale them. They were 6, 7, 8 feet high, and often this is what they did to essentially show up on the doorsteps of villagers in Pechera and some of the outlying villages to beg for food, and then they would sneak back into the camp, evading some of the local Ukrainian policemen, and to bring food back to their families to help sustain them. As soon these children began to sense that there was less danger on the outside, that there were fewer gendarmes patrolling, it seemed that even when they were caught by the gendarmes, the Romanian military policemen, that they would be kind of released and not really even severely punished. So they eventually made it further and further and reached ghettos that actually they perceived as safer than the very camp that they were imprisoned in. So over time, especially in the spring of 1943, in the last year of the Romanian occupation, many prisoners in Pechera actually begin to, those who have survived begin to slowly make their way to nearby ghettos. And this is where they spend the final year of the war until their liberation by the Red Army.
As you pointed out earlier in our discussion, you really are weaving a story of a family that straddled the 20th century. So your book goes beyond the Holocaust. One of the things that really stands out to me in reading is the way that memory factors in to this larger story. Like many Soviet Jews, your family had to grapple with the silences concerning Jewish experiences of the Holocaust and the difficulties of rebuilding in post-war Soviet Ukraine. What did this look like for them?
Well, in March of 1944, when the Red Army showed up and liberated Transnistria, there were about 20,000 of the 200,000 or so Soviet Jews still left alive in this territory, and about 50,000 of the 150,000 or so Romanian Jews that had survived Transnistria. For the Romanian Jews, often the story was that they eventually managed to return to Romania, and over the next couple of decades, many of them emigrated to Israel. For the local Soviet Jews, their story was very much about returning to the hometowns from which they had been taken, and basically to somehow rebuild their lives. In the case of my grandfather, he returned by foot with his mother, his three siblings who had all survived. And he found that the old Jewish quarter in Tulchin was pretty much decimated. Many of the homes were taken apart. The Jewish homes were taken apart for firewood. They were stripped down to the foundations. All of their household items had essentially been taken by the locals. And so there was no place to turn. And so the immediate task to tend to was to continue to find a way to survive. My grandfather essentially found an abandoned shack, tore off the lock, and welcomed his family inside. And that's where they would live for the next basically 20 years, because there was a severe housing shortage, and it took a long time for the Soviets to be able to provide housing. As far as rebuilding, that wasn't even that was just the beginning of the. Right after the war, another famine hit Ukraine, and for many people, they returned to their towns and villages only to discover that many of the fathers, brothers, friends, husbands who had been sent off to war would not return. This was true for many members of my family. And the other thing that happened was that there was suddenly a huge demographic shift in many of the towns. In Tulchin, as I mentioned, Jews had once constituted nearly half of the population. And now they were vastly outnumbered by Ukrainians. Instead of living in their own enclave, now they lived amongst ethnic Ukrainians, in their neighborhoods. And what happened is that many survivors, they began to grow self-conscious about their Jewish identities and their speech. Some chose to speak Yiddish only in private. Some renounced their names. I noticed an interesting trend in my own family, in that pretty much after this generation, there was very much an effort to give Russian names to children. And the other thing that happened was often they were met by... and I should say more broadly, in the Soviet Union, survivors were met by people who didn't necessarily believe that they had, in fact, survived some of these horrific conditions and atrocities. There was a belief that all Jews had lived out the war, on the so-called Tashkent Front. There was not a belief that that Jewish men and women had fought in the Red Army. And so they had to kind of live with these accusations as well. In some ways, my family was also lucky, because many people returned home to find that their houses were occupied, and there was very little they could do about it due to a law that basically revoked their rights after a certain period of time in which they were absent. And then also in the years to come, there were other reminders of what happened in the war, even after they after their survival and after they had gotten back on their feet. In my grandfather's case, there was a run-in with a local Ukrainian camp guard who had apparently, like many others, served out a shortened sentence, probably a labor sentence, and was able to return to the very town in which he had served as basically a camp guard. And so this was quite common. People who were accused of being collaborators, in many cases walking freely, and their survivors having to sort of adjust to this reality after a number of years. And then as far as I think, you know, living with you know, in the shadow of the Holocaust, I think sometimes there's often an assumption that in the Soviet Union, there was a single consistent policy, I think, dictating what could be said and not said, written and not written, movies that could be made and not made. And it turns out that this wasn't necessarily the case, and it certainly depended on the specific period that you're talking about. But I think what was definitely true was that the Holocaust was subsumed into a larger war narrative. It was subsumed by the larger suffering of all Soviet citizens. And certainly there was no way for Soviet Jews to be able to begin to communicate their stories to the outside world until really, you know, probably the late 80s or so. And I'll also say that, you know, even for the average person who's not writing literature or producing films, people eking out livings in the periphery of the Soviet Union, far from any major city, you know, I don't think there was a concern necessarily that the KGB would suddenly come knocking on your door if you happened to, you know, talk about the Holocaust to somebody or what had happened to you. But there was definitely a societal taboo around discussing the specificity of the Jewish wartime experience. It's just not something that, as it was told to me, not something that you would necessarily share outside of your circle. You know, it could be the grounds for getting fired, for getting kicked out of university. But as even in spite of this, there were a number of survivors whose testimony I listened to and who I interviewed that actually fought against, in some ways, this kind of veil of silence. Many of them basically came of age and helped preserve, in many cases, the mass graves where their relatives now were. They erected memorials, and they appealed to local Soviet authorities for the right to do this. And in this way, in the ways that they could, they kept the memory alive. But I would say that the lack of validation, quite frankly, had a way of re-traumatizing the people whose stories I heard. One of the most obvious ways was that many of the sites that were camps and ghettos were not marked as such until very late in the Soviet period. The camp that my grandfather had survived did not even have a plaque identifying the fact that it had been a death camp until 1989. This was again a little bit traumatic for certain people. One of the people whose stories I tell, he was a child survivor who was about 12 years old at the end of the war, and he had no memory of this place because of the poor health that he was in. And you know, many years later, while living in Kiev, he decided to take his son basically on a kind of a vacation, as kind of a bonding moment after his son was done with his first year at university. And he unknowingly booked a trip to the very village where the camp was located, because the camp itself had been transformed into a health resort after the war. It had, of course, been renovated, fixed up, and so there was no trace of what happened. And during this vacation, the survivor quickly realized where he was as a boy, and it was deeply troubling to him. And I think for my grandfather, I think even in the United States, when he was telling this story, you know, many decades after what had happened to him, the thing that didn't necessarily bother him at that point, he would tell me, he had come to terms with what happened, but what I think bothered him was that he didn't necessarily get the validation for some of the things that he did, because when he, for example, tried to reach out to a few of the folks that he saved, and there's some of their sons and daughters, they simply had not been told, because, you know, this was not necessarily, you know, the kind of thing that you would share with one's family. So I think in his last few years, I think this was what really troubled him most of all. And so I think this veil of silence, it definitely had an impact many years after the war had ended.
I now want to kind of shift things towards your parents and towards your own experience. Scholar Marianne Hirsch has done a lot of work on the topic of post-memory, that is, how Holocaust-related trauma impacts the next generations. I think your book offers a really stark glimpse into the way that your grandparents' experiences and the silences around them have shaped your parents and your understandings of self, of Jewishness, of Soviet Jewishness. I was wondering if you might be willing to share a little bit about this with listeners today.
Well, you know, what I've come to understand, I think, while digging into some of this family history and speaking to my grandparents and others about these difficult periods in their lives, is that I think certainly the events of the war defined the arc of their lives, and both directly and indirectly shaped their identities. You know, but I think their identities as Soviet Jews and Jews more broadly was probably shaped even well before the Holocaust. And I thought, again, digging into some of this history was incredibly informative in that respect. And for me, helped answer a number of questions about my own family and why things were the way they were, and how our own identities differed from, those in the American Jewish community. I think, in the 1960s, at the beginning of the Soviet Jewry movement that sought to help allow Soviet Jews to basically emigrate to the West, which would culminate in just that 20 years later into Israel as well. I think there was this image of Soviet Jews as part of this kind of intelligentsia, people who were very much interested in reclaiming their Jewish past, who were trying to relearn some of the cultural religious practices. And I think that the people who actually came to the United States, again, 20, 30 years later, were not quite what was maybe expected by the people who had kind of fought so hard to give us the right to come to this country as Jewish refugees. And for me, I myself had a hard time reconciling why it was that my family approached our Jewish identity so differently than some of my Jewish American friends while growing up. I felt that they were more at ease with their identities. They seemed to know so much more than me about cultural, religious practices, things that were done and not done. I think digging into some of this history, dating back to the years before the Russian Revolution, the difficult years of the Soviet Union pre-war, and the attempts to really eradicate religion, and of course the difficult periods that followed the war as well. I think these were all incredibly instructive as far as how I now view my identity, how it was forged, and how I think I'll probably approach the future with my own family.
Maxim, we've taken up quite a bit of your time today. I want to wrap up our interview with my traditional closing question on New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
I think mainly now I want to spend some time recovering from the writing and research process and all the work that went into that. For me, this was mostly done between the hours of 9 p.m. and 1 a.m., so I'm definitely... my immediate plans are to catch up on some sleep. But I do think there is certainly a lot to be explored on the topics, we chatted about today. And I think it's possible, you know, at a later point that I'll want to dig in again. But for now, I think I'm just going to enjoy some time with family and some books that I've been meaning to read and movies and things like that. But maybe, yes, I think at a later date, I think maybe inspiration will strike and I'll maybe wade into this material, because again, I think there is so much more to do and learn.
Amazing. I, for one, hope you do wade back into it, because I really enjoyed reading this book. I want to thank you personally for joining us here on New Books in Jewish Studies today, Maxim.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
And for the listeners out there, if today's discussion piqued your interest, you can pick up a copy of Maxim Goldenstein's So They Remember, A Jewish Family's Story of Surviving the Holocaust in Soviet Ukraine, directly from University of Oklahoma Press, or you can order it from your local bookstore.